You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's pod is with Charles Piller, who writes investigative stories for Science. He previously worked as an investigative journalist for STAT, the Los Angeles Times, and the Sacramento Bee, and he's reported on public health, biological warfare, infectious disease, outbreaks, and other topics from the United States, Africa, Asia, Europe, and Central America. He's written a number of books, but his latest is called Doctored: Fraud, Arrogance, and Tragedy in the Quest to Cure Alzheimer's. This is going to be a good one. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another bed and left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops. But over time, the expectations...
Charles Piller, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Kelly. I'm very happy to be with you.
You open your book with the following words, quote, "In December of 2021... I fell into one of the biggest and most disturbing stories of my career. A credible whistleblower with strong credentials in dementia research tipped me to a major case of apparent misconduct in the field," end quote. Let's start there.
Okay.
What you got this tip, and then what happened?
Well, off to the races, really.
Yeah.
Back in December 2021, I was talking with this guy, Matthew Schrag, who's an investigator and neuroscientist clinician at Vanderbilt University. And he was doing some research integrity work in his spare time, so not associated with his university job. And he had been instrumental in finding some apparent problems in research underlying a new Alzheimer's drug called simufilam. Now, that is a long story. That drug has crashed and burned. We can talk about it, but I'm going to just jump forward to what in many ways was a much more interesting and important development, which was in honing his ability to see problems in images in scientific studies. In other words, to do what they call forensic image analysis of these images that are representing the results of experiments. He stumbled across problems in one of the most influential studies in Alzheimer's disease that had been run in decades. And it was pretty stunning. I remember the first conversation that Matt Schrag and I had about this, and both of us were just kind of silenced by the implications of what was seen in his analysis.
You know, I've seen this written about so many times that whistleblowers, it doesn't end well for the whistleblower normally.
True enough. And believe me, it was a long journey to have Matt Schrag be able to put his name on the record associated with this long series of stories that I ended up doing in Science Magazine, and then also, of course, the book. And he showed an remarkable courage, but it literally took 4 months of discussions for him to be willing to roll the dice on being publicly known. And I might add that, you know, we can go into the whys and wherefores of it, but just talking about Matt for a second, he realized, as I did early on, and as my editors at Science did, that this was more than just a dry recitation of scientific findings. It had to be a journey, a story told through the eyes of the whistleblower in order for it to have impact and for it to reach people, patients, doctors, and scientists, everyone really who's affected by the disease, to have a sense of the human dimensions. And he sweated that mightily, because as you say, it can end badly for whistleblowers. It has so many times. I'm relieved to say that nothing too terrible has happened to him. Mm-hmm. So as a result of all the publicity that has occurred associated with his revealing his identity publicly.
So this is such an interesting thing, because it's a complex topic. It is, there's drug names that are hard to pronounce. I mean, I did so many phonetic notations on my notes. But there's a thriller aspect to this in terms of what happened to the people and your conversations with folks. So I did my notes as I normally do, which is I underline and I go for each. But then I had to break out a little like cheat sheet that I'm showing you here, where I'm like, all right, the drugs or the treatments, the players, the companies, the research. And I think I want to start with this research. And this is Hardy and Higgins in 1992, the amyloid cascade hypothesis. It feels like that's the start in many ways to this.
It really is. It's a good starting point, because it ended up being one of the most influential studies ever done in the history of Alzheimer's disease, influential commentary studies.
So what is it like? What is that?
Okay. So this is really fundamental to understanding the context of my book, Doctored. And what this is that idea that a particular type of protein, initially called amyloid plaques, these are clumps of this certain kind of protein that accumulate in the brain. We now know through further research that there are different forms of amyloid protein. Some of them are soluble and they float around in the spinal fluid that bathes your brain. So this paper described the amyloid plaque influence on Alzheimer's disease, that basically said that these led to a cascade of effects in the brain that ultimately led to the cognitive problems associated with Alzheimer's disease. And it was a very, very important theory for a few reasons. One is that it made a lot of sense. It was a logical theory. Here's a situation where in autopsies of people who died after experiencing dementia, it was obvious that there was a lot of amyloid plaque in their brain. And it fit together nicely to tell a story about how that may have progressed and may lead to the kind of dementia that we see that's so common. And so consequently, it gained immediate currency in the scientific world. It became almost immediately the dominant way of looking at Alzheimer's disease.
To the point of kind of eschewing other roads, to the point of millions, could it be billions of dollars?
Yes, billions. Certainly billions of dollars have been spent in trying to prove out the amyloid hypothesis and to substantiate the importance of it in Alzheimer's disease. Now, let me make it clear that I believe, and I think most scientists who study this believe, I'm not a scientist, I'm a journalist, but I've talked to a lot of scientists about this, and it's very clear that amyloid proteins have some role in Alzheimer's disease. Nothing in my book disputes that. That said, there's really big questions about whether the amyloid hypothesis, which is that this protein causes this cascade of effects in the brain that leads to dementia, whether that is the right story and the full story, and whether it makes the most sense scientifically. And there's a lot of dispute about that.
So in a moment, I want to start talking about some of these people. Before we do that, though, you write in the book, quote, between 1992 and 2015, rates for the top three causes of death in the United States fell sharply. So that would be cancer, heart disease, and stroke. But in the aging population, Alzheimer's rates and fatalities went in the opposite direction.
It's true. It's unbelievably tragic. It's one of the cruelest of all ailments, as I think many people listening to this will understand from their own family experience. It's just a terrible disease that steals your sense of self along with your memories. And it's such a big problem. And that's why it's so tragic that it's taking decades and decades to make any progress, unlike some of those other tragic illnesses and problems, big killers, in fact. There has been really no remedy so far that is able to reverse the effects of dementia caused by Alzheimer's.
So before we talk about the people. My mom had dementia, and I remember going to the home that she was in, having these conversations, and she'd sort of veer off to talk about her nursing career, like she was a nurse, that sort of thing. And I very frustrating. I kept trying to like get her back to, you know, the reality, which was certainly my reality, not her reality. And I was driving home from the facility, and I was listening to This American Life, the NPR show, and they happened to have a segment on these two folks who were improvisers who were dealing with the mom who had dementia, and they decided to, rather than block her, use the yes and method of just sort of saying yes and what happened then. Yes and what. And I remember pulling over and just sobbing because I wrote the damn book Yes and I didn't know to do that with my mom.
Hmm.
And so, you know, this topic, and I think the reason, as I've been talking to people while I read your book, it's like cancer, this feels like something that has touched almost everyone, if not everyone in some way, extended family, friends, that sort of thing, which makes the whole thing that much more heartbreaking. It's probably been in your family, right?
Yeah, absolutely right. In fact, my mom was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, and you know, this is very personal for me. Obviously, it touches so many people. And that's why, to me, it's not just important for there to be excellent scientific research that goes after the causes and the possible solutions, but also to look at the possible foibles and missteps, and even in some cases, falsification of data that may have set us back some in understanding and curing Alzheimer's ultimately.
So the people you talk about are a fascinating group of people because they are degreed. Some are very vain. Some are maybe not apparently that. You start by talking about Lindsay Burns. So can you tell us about her?
Sure. So Lindsay Burns was an executive at an Alzheimer's disease research company that was developing a drug called simufilam for Alzheimer's. And she was a person who was deeply, deeply enmeshed in a series of studies with a guy at City University of New York, by the name of Hu Yung Wang. And he and Burns were working on a remedy, this remedy, simufilam, which was purportedly one that could really be beneficial and perhaps even arrest the progression of Alzheimer's disease. Now, it's a kind of a long story, but it turns out after a lot of study and a lot of testing in patients that this drug had no benefit and was recently declared a failure in its trials by the company Cassava Sciences that was behind it. The really tragic difficulty with this is that the evidence was strong that the data behind it had been falsified. In other words, there was a lot of suggestions that the company, perhaps, and this investigator from City University of New York had presented data that was suggesting great benefits from the drug when actually it was a misrepresentation. Now, that case is being adjudicated to some degree. There was a big settlement with the government between the makers of the drug, Cassava Sciences, and this resulted in the CEO of the company and Lindsay Burns, who is married to him, leaving the company and having to pay fines, and $40 million fine being paid by Cassava Sciences to the government for as a settlement, not admitting fault. And the doctor from City University of New York, he has been indicted for possible fraudulent activities associated with his work on this drug. So it's a sad, difficult story that involved what, you know, some people might call an exploitation of thousands of patients who were enrolled in clinical trials associated with that. It's a story that I think exemplifies the desperation that people feel in finding some sort of remedy or cure for Alzheimer's disease. And even when things look suspicious, people are just willing to take a leap of faith.
The other two characters who loom large are Karen Ash and Sylvain Lesnay, if I'm saying it right.
Sylvain Lesnay, yeah. Yeah. So these were, these are, I should say, scientists at the University of Minnesota. And so this is a really interesting story that I think is sort of at the heart of understanding what some of the problems in Alzheimer's disease research have been. So these two researchers were behind what ended up being a very landmark study in the history of studying Alzheimer's disease. And so just to give a tiny bit of scientific background to have listeners clue into some of the words I'm going to be using. So Alzheimer's is thought to be caused by an accumulation of these so-called amyloid proteins in the brain. And there are other factors as well, but that's one of the really big ones. And so what these scientists found is that they did an experiment with mice where they were able to create mice that were producing copious amounts of this protein in their brains, and then to find a certain segment of that protein, because these amyloid proteins take different forms, that they decided, based on their experimentation, was really the culprit, the key culprit in the introducing Alzheimer's disease in people when it was produced in the human brain. And so they did an interesting experiment where they injected this refined form of this particular protein into the brains of rats, and they found that it caused a kind of confusion akin to Alzheimer's dementia in the rats. And this was really interesting experiment that caught the attention of the scientific community, because it was kind of a cause and effect demonstration of what might be behind Alzheimer's dementia, obviously in rats. So it had to be proved out in humans. But what we learned from that is that it looked like they had come on a discovery that could open up a really distinct set of horizons of how to explain and treat Alzheimer's disease. So after this occurred, there was enormous amount of investment in the industry into understanding better this kind of finding that Lesnay and his mentor, Karen Ash, found in their laboratory experiments. And an enormous amount of money went into it. And it had occurred in a time when there was already kind of a discouragement going on in the world of Alzheimer's research, that they might have been barking up the wrong tree. They had been trying for a long time to extract these amyloid proteins from the brain, and they were able to do, to a large degree, pretty successful in doing that without reaching a point where they were able to show success cognitively. In other words, they could remove what was supposedly the cause of the disease, but people weren't improving. And so it was mysterious. But this finding that the specific type of amyloid protein might be the culprit led to a lot of new research and a lot of acclaim and a lot of spending, and really boosted the standing of the amyloid hypothesis of the disease in the scientific community. So that was a key to it. So what I looked at in the first story that I wrote about this disease, and this was with the incredible creative and important work of a guy by the name of Matthew Schrag, who is a scientist at Vanderbilt University. And he was someone who was concerned about the possibility that some images in certain Alzheimer's research had been improperly changed or doctored. And what he found is that there was strong evidence that this seminal experiment that came out of the lab of this woman, Karen Ash, and her associate, Sylvain Lesnay, at the University of Minnesota, had actually been based on improper doctored science. And he felt that that was enough of a concern, and it was sufficiently validated in his own observations and in other ways to raise it, call it to public attention. And so the way that happened was that I got a hold of Schrag's information. He and I talked for months and months about this and went over it in great, excruciating detail. And then I shared it with lots of important scientists and experts in forensic image analysis to validate the concerns, to find out if they seemed to hold water. And uniformly among the experts with whom I spoke, both in the subject matter of Alzheimer's and in this analysis methodology, there was an agreement that there was a really serious problem here. So this seminal study that set the industry really on a very close and important path in uncovering the causes behind Alzheimer's seemed to have been based on apparently doctored images.
So there's sort of three things going on here. And that what you're talking about right now is Matthew's work, where he's looking at these images and he's noting that this stuff is not checking out. And you talk about so my audience will understand this with regard to the replication crisis in behavioral science, because we work with a lot of behavioral scientists and even people I've had in this podcast who've, you know, fallen into a lot of problems in terms of their work appearing to be fraudulent, however. And you meet these data thugs, so-called data thugs. I think you find yourself overseas talking to them. And so it's almost like a group that is, they're set out to, you know, find this stuff, but in unorthodox ways because they have to.
Yeah, it's true. So one of the big problems, I think, that this whole range of research, not just my book, but also lots of other people doing this work and thinking about the possibility of falsification of data within scientific images and scientific research, is the issue that there hasn't been good oversight by the institutional authorities that are charged with the task of ensuring the reliability of these important studies. So there's been a lot of complacency by the journals in. Look, I speak advisedly about this. I work for a journal called Science, which, of course, many listeners are going to know is one of the leading scientific journals in the world. And I work on the news side of it. I'm not personally a scientist. But what I think is clear, even though journals like Science and Nature, some of the big journals, others, have really tightened up their policies regarding checking for the possibility of image doctoring, image fraud in their work, in the work that they publish, this has been an enormous problem, and there are so many scientific journals that it's taken a long time for people to start to catch up with the problem of image doctoring and the problem of image falsification and how it might influence research. So in this case, the implications of this apparently doctored study were pretty enormous. They called into question some fundamental ideas about the way in which Alzheimer's research has progressed over the years. And I'm not saying, let me make it very clear. I'm a big believer in science. I'm a big believer in scientific research. I am not calling into question scientific research more generally. I would personally think that it's very important to emphasize that most scientists are people of integrity. Most scientists are deeply determined to showing their work can proceed incrementally to finding out new discoveries that are helpful to people and helpful to advancing knowledge. I do not believe it's the kind of thing where most scientists are corrupt in some way, but some are. It's like any other walk of life, and we'd be fools to think otherwise. There are times when people either make terrible mistakes and go down a wrong path or are deliberately manipulating information, some of which I describe in my book.
Yeah, there's a couple things I'd add to that. You talked to George Perry at the University of Texas, San Antonio, and he says, quote, "The major goal of these people is to win. If it isn't the Nobel Prize, it's God's glory," which I think is. And so you have this sort of vanity impulse. Then the incentives are bad. I mean, that is over and over again. When you look at what went on at FDA, NIH, the amount of money that is going across a table to someone, and maybe that person who helps say okay to the money a few years down the line ends up with that company that they gave them money. I mean, that should never be allowed. It's much like the lobbyist situation that we know about in DC.
Yeah, there's no question that there's a revolving door company with our regulators back and forth to industry. There's absolutely no question about it. I would say that there has been complacency in the regulatory structure towards these kinds of problems, terrible complacency. And as a result, we've seen, you know, a lot of doctored studies, studies that have been false or are unreliable. Now, what's so terrible is that the vast majority of studies that are written in science generally, and I think in Alzheimer's research specifically, are completely legit studies. And I'm not calling into question those. I'm merely saying that there has been lapses that have not been well handled by the agencies that are charged with doing so. And it has led to confusion. And it has led, I'm afraid, to some false starts and problems. If I could just mention, Kelly, briefly, an example I think that shows that this is a problem of pretty big proportions that has kind of gone under the radar for a while. So I wrote a story for Science magazine, and it's also described in detail in my book, about a guy by the name of Eliezer Mosleh, who is one of the most important scientists historically in Alzheimer's disease. Just for example, his body of work, about 800 plus papers, has been cited in scientific publications more than almost anybody in the Alzheimer's field. And consequently, he's had a lot of influence. And then in 2016, he became the head of the part of NIH that manages a lot of the Alzheimer's portfolio in the National Institute on Aging. And this is a guy who was seemed to be well qualified for that job. He was an illustrious scientist who had influenced the field in many ways, and some of his work had resulted in drugs coming to market and even drug development and from important companies. And so it was pretty shocking when, as part of my research for the book, working with a team of experts who were able to evaluate these studies, evaluate the images in these studies, that they found that Mosley's work was riddled with an enormous number of apparently doctored images. And so this resulted in, you know, when I say enormous, I mean 130 of his studies were found to have improprieties of that kind, or I should say apparent improprieties, because I want to be careful to say that these aren't necessarily all proven to be elements of a series of misconduct actions that are misconduct, but they are all strong evidence that something needs to be investigated more fully and show signs of image doctoring, very serious signs. So, of course, as part of my reporting, I brought this to the National Institutes on Health, National Institutes of Health, to his bosses, basically, and to ask the question, you know, what do you make of this? What is the answer to these apparent improprieties, image doctoring, that would have a dramatic effect on not just one study or two studies or three studies, but a whole range of research by one of the most important people in the funding of Alzheimer's disease in the world? And so they demurred and didn't respond to my questions for a long time. But then finally, at the 11th hour, they came back to me and told me that he was being removed from his job as a result of their own investigation, which looked at two studies. And they found image doctoring in two studies. They definitively found that. They didn't address the other 128 studies that were described in my work, but let me make this point. This was a guy sitting at the pinnacle of funding decisions for this disease. And whether or not he had apparent image doctoring or other improprieties in 128 other studies, we know for sure the agency decided he had done so in a couple. And I think it represents that this is a really serious issue and serious set of problems. It does not contaminate every element of science. It does not contaminate all the legitimate scientists who have nothing but noble and correct ways of operating in their labs, even if other people disagree with their findings. But it shows that it's a problem of pretty large proportions that needs to be dealt with in an effective way. And the agencies like the National Institutes of Health and others are really behind in keeping up with it.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier my own personal experience with this, and we actually ended up creating an improvisation for caregivers program with a group called Caring Across Generations in the Cleveland Clinic. And it was teaching caregivers, and this could be home caregivers, nurses, doctors, improvisational skills, which are about deep listening, about listening to understand what someone's really saying or what they're not saying, having each other's back, really pro-social, psychological safety kind of stuff. And I will say, and because we had a health crisis in my family, that utilizing these tools inside those hospital settings was very powerful, and most people were great about it. I remember the one person who wasn't in our situation was the world-renowned surgeon who did not want to be called into question. And and we were relying on this guy, and he was not a bad guy necessarily, but it was clear. It was what he said, and it was, there is a scene in this book which shook me to the core, and it's you in Karen Ash's office at the University of Minnesota, where maybe she's the only one who agreed to sit down face to face with you.
No, there were a few others, but she was one of the very, very few.
Very, very few. Can you talk us about what? Because it had to be extraordinary for you to sit there and listen to what she was saying, because it felt like a cascade of emotions sort of coming through or seeping through at a time. And there's another person in the office who you say like wished to be anywhere but there. Talk to us about that setting.
Sure. So just to give a tiny bit of background to set it up, Karen Ash and her colleague Sylvain Lesnay were the scientists behind this at one time seminal study on the study of the disease at the University of Minnesota, and had been highly acclaimed for that work. And so long time after my initial article on this subject came out in Science Magazine, and you could say kind of took that apart and caused an enormous amount of focus on the veracity of that work. I might add that that study was finally retracted by the journal that published it, which was Nature. And that study was retracted, and there was an admission by Karen Ash, the woman you mentioned, the scientist you mentioned, that the study was based on false images. They didn't have a full explanation for how that happened, but they agreed that there were these problems. But just to set the scene, this was a long time after my initial story had appeared, and I had been trying to get an interview with Karen Ash literally for a couple of years. Yeah. And she always demurred, but finally she agreed that it would be good to meet. And I deeply appreciated this. It was a very generous gesture on her part, and she showed a lot of integrity to invite me into her environment after the story that I wrote caused her a lot of anguish, even though ultimately she agreed that the study needed to be retracted. It was still a terrible situation for her. This is an illustrious scientist who had made many important contributions to the study of Alzheimer's disease. And my heart went out to her, honestly, as a human being. We had a sit down where it became extremely awkward because she pretty much just blamed me for everything. It was a very awkward, difficult conversation. But one of the reasons why it was awkward is that she had a real appeal to her religious faith and her determination to kind of impress upon me the importance of showing more humility in my own work. And it was a very, for a journalist, very awkward situation, and try to impress upon me that even though this initial study she acknowledged was based on apparently false data, which I might add was not her falsification, but was falsification apparently coming from the scientist who she worked with, a protege of hers by the name of Sylvain Lesnay. And that is still being adjudicated by the university these years later. But the study itself has been pulled from the record, of course. And so it was a very awkward, strange conversation because personally, I like Karen Ash. I find her to be a deeply determined person who believes so strongly in what she's doing. But it was awkward because it was difficult for her to accept that there are checks and balances in the conduct of these studies. And she was trying to convince me that I had erred by showing the difficulties and the challenges and the incorrect assumptions of this study in a public way, when I should have maybe given her a chance to examine it herself and correct the record. It was, for a journalist, it was an awkward moment, to say the very least.
Yeah, well, I think when she says, it's not my soul, it's your soul, is a pretty, I mean, I don't know what novel.
I laugh a little bit, but only out of awkwardness, because honestly, as a human being, I just have great sympathy for Karen Ash. My article made her life very difficult and brought a lot of heat down on her, and anyone would be deeply disturbed by that. But the implications of publishing false research for the community of scientists, for patients, for the way in which it, not singly, not on its own, but as part of a trend and set of ideas in the field that really sidetracked a lot of thinking in Alzheimer's disease and concentrated attention quite closely on this one way of thinking about it, the so-called amyloid hypothesis of the disease. This, you know, by many other scientists' estimations, was a big setback for the field because it closed off for many years other avenues of study. And I think the difficulty she had in accepting this was a very human thing. And I have, as a human being, I'm very sympathetic to the challenges and the pain that whole episode in no doubt caused her, because look, of course, I respect her as a person and she's been an eminent scientist, but of course I also have to disagree with her assumptions that the role of journalism is to write about things and to expose details of situations, even if they're painful, to review carefully. And to me, that was my highest order goal. Of course, I care about people that I write about, but you can't let that stop you from bringing out the truth.
No, because I mean, there's I think for those of us who are living in the world right now, we're January 31st, 2025, where the norms don't exist, where science is being called into question. It's like, of course science gets it wrong, and then it gets it right, and then it's wrong again. This is how that works. So it's so important for us to be able to have responsible gray areas to play in, and they're disappearing because the world seems to be interested in a zero-sum game. And it doesn't seem to be the province of one side or the other. You have these eminent scientists who want to be, you know, God figures, and you've got other people who are charlatans and that sort of thing. But all of this is in play because it's like we're losing the thread here, people. What we really want to do is try to cure this horrible disease. And the way we're not going to cure it is through falsified research.
Indeed. And I think it's important to emphasize, Kelly, that there is a kind of, I don't know if it's appropriate, but I could guess you could describe it as groupthink that it can occur. And you have a situation where the amyloid hypothesis of the disease makes a lot of sense. You see these amyloid proteins in the brain of people who have Alzheimer's or who die from Alzheimer's. And it's a terrible, terrible condition. But there are lots of contradictions that need to encourage people to look more broadly and to widen their horizons on this. Just to give you an example, amyloid proteins are in the brains of many people who never get Alzheimer's symptoms. And consequently, it can be confusing. But this dominant way of looking at the disease captured a lot of the mind share and actually pushed the publications, the scientific publications, the funders, the federal government, to favor this at the expense of a lot of other ways of thinking about it and looking at other alternative explanations for Alzheimer's disease. And so what happened is you had this long period of time where there haven't been good remedies developed, but there still is an enormous amount of the funding going in this one direction. And so I think that's a tragic set of affairs. Now, I want to say quite clearly that listeners may be aware that there are drugs on the market now, only in the last couple of years, that are based on the removal of certain amyloid proteins from the brain. And There are studies that have suggested that these have a very small beneficial effect in cognition. And I think people should look closely at the set of issues. It's a very heavily disputed question about whether they really have a beneficial effect or not. They also have certain possible harms they're associated with. All of the studies have shown that they have the propensity to cause brain swelling and bleeding in certain people who take them. These can be very dangerous at times, not always. And there's a lot of evidence to show that many people can take these drugs and not be physically harmed by them. But the benefits are very much in debate in the scientific community. And when I say that, what I mean is that these are drugs that do not reverse the effects of Alzheimer's disease. They do not arrest the effects of Alzheimer's disease. In other words, you can take the drug, but you don't suddenly stop having your cognition degrade if you're a person who is suffering from Alzheimer's. And you certainly don't reverse the effects. So even if you accept, and this is not accepted by everyone, it's debated, that the drugs have a meaningful effect on cognition, it's so slight that, you know, given the attendant cost and physical risks associated with taking the drugs, there's disputes about whether they're even a good idea in the scientific community. So it's a pretty important set of concerns and debates that really should be aired out continually by scientists and by regulators.
So in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, which is how we end the podcast. But you, when you were visiting Karen Ash, she said that she hadn't talked to Lesnay in what, maybe a couple of years or something like that?
That's right, yeah.
But then you saw him on campus, right?
I did, at a distance.
That had to be wild.
That was a moment. And, you know, I have to say that I wish I had had the opportunity to sit down with Lesnay, such an important player in my book. You know, completely unwilling to engage with me. And personally, I can't say what the rationale for that is. I can't presuppose what his thoughts were. But what I can say is that readers would be keenly interested in his story and what led him to the decisions that he made and the experiments that he was involved in and that he's been blamed for, in not just blamed by the evidence that was described in my article, but also by people in the field. And it's a tragic story and a difficult story, and one that I wished I could have told more fully from his perspective. But, you know, I'd like to leave you a little bit, Kelly, with something a little bit more hopeful, because this is a sad story, and yep, it's one that is replete with challenges and difficulties that we're all concerned about. But there is a reason to hope that Alzheimer's will eventually be solved. The puzzle will be solved. And there's a lot of interesting new ideas in the field right now. One is this idea that the GLP-1 inhibitors, and these are the drugs that have been used for weight loss, might also have a potentially beneficial effect on the cognitive decline associated with Alzheimer's. And they are being tested out in patients, and the results of those experiments may be coming in about a year or so. That's very interesting work. The preliminary results at least show that it's a possibility that they may have a beneficial effect. That's one, a surprising one. The other thing I wanted to mention regarding hopeful ideas is that I think people should realize that it's within their power to fight against the worst effects of Alzheimer's disease by maintaining a healthful lifestyle, by remembering that they can push back against cognitive decline by exercising your mind and being willing to even consider the possibility that some new drug developments might be helpful and keep track of those. But I think the main thing is that eating a healthful diet, remembering to exercise and to maintain a healthful lifestyle, and to keep up with the research and to educate yourself and to keep in touch with your loved ones and to try to make your life as good as possible can help stave off the worst effects of imminent cognitive decline that can occur. And these are not panaceas. Healthful lifestyles alone aren't going to stop people from getting Alzheimer's disease if they are destined to get it. But they can hold it at bay to some degree, and they can, in studies, have shown that if you pay close attention to your mental hygiene, the same way we look at our physical hygiene, it can have a benefit that is important in your life.
Yeah, and this comes up in the podcast all the time with the variety of scientists that we talk to, you know, taking a walk outside, experiencing awe, moving out from your screen. There's so many different things that we can do to take care of ourselves. And that keeping check of your mind and your soul and your spirit are all part of that. And yes, it won't stave off various tragedies and other things happen, but you do have some agency within that. I cannot wait to hear what your yes and story is.
Okay. So about 2.5 years ago, I was very fortunate to become a grandfather for the first time.
Oh, great.
And it's become one of the most important parts of my life. But I was at the time at the outset of writing this book, and I was under enormous pressure, also doing stories for Science, the publication that I work for. And I was faced with this big question from my son and daughter-in-law, which is, would I be willing to 2 days a week help take care of the baby after the first 6 months, after everybody went back to work after their leaves? And honestly, it terrified me. It terrified me because I was, well, first of all, because it's been a long time since I was hanging out with a little baby, but it also terrified me because I was working on this book and had a lot of pressure and work bearing down on me. But I made a decision that this was something that doesn't come around in life very often, and I had to just take the leap and go for it. And what I found was that the experience of being with this small child invigorated me psychologically and emotionally in ways that were pretty much irreplaceable, and made me, even though I had to work harder in my other hours of my day and my weekend, it made me realize that this was one of the most important things of life that I wouldn't have wanted to miss for anything, including the pressure of writing this book.
What a gift. And this, you know, Dan Pink was on the podcast. He's been on a bunch of times, and his last book talks about regret and the regrets that people have, and the regrets end up being people like not taking that chance, right? Mm-hmm. Like it would be so. It is easier to say no, but nothing great in life ever happened to me that was easy.
True, and I have to say the reward, which is a wonderful close relationship with my granddaughter, is something that's unique in life and something that I really treasure every single day.
Oh, it's great. The book is called Doctored: Fraud, Arrogance, and Tragedy in the Quest to Cure Alzheimer's. Charles Pillar, thank you for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Kelly. I appreciate it.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com. Screaming atop of their lungs.
survives.
Survive.